our brother Nathan Luke will lead us in the reading of Isaiah chapter 4. Thank you, Nathan.
Reading together, brethren and sisters and young people, Isaiah chapter 4. And in that day, seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, "We will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach." In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof, by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. And Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defence. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from the storm and from rain.
Now I'd like to ask our brother Brian to lead us in a study of that chapter to the theme, the branch of beauty and of glory.
Brother Chairman and my dear brethren and sisters and our young people, it's very nice to see Philip welcoming us tonight, wasn't it? I thought perhaps we might be welcoming him, but he's back in the old chair again and present with us at our Bible class. In the opening of Isaiah chapter 4, there is a phrase that is repeated in verse 1 and 2. And it's important to note that connection because it gives us the sense of the fourth chapter. It says, "And in that day the seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach." Now, the previous chapter, as we know, had two main sections. But the last half had to do with the proud daughters of Jerusalem, verse 16. "Moreover, Yahweh saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet." And they're mentioned again in verse 17 under that description of the daughters of Zion. "Therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion." And from there on, my dear brothers and sisters, though we didn't last time go into that in detail, you will know that it mentions all the type of things which the women of Israel were apparently using as part of their attire and get-up. And so it mentions in verse 18, "In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments, about their feet and their cauls and their round tires like the moon, the chains, the bracelets, the mufflers," so on. So in chapter 4, verse 1, where it says, "And in that day the seven women shall take hold of one man," it's noting therefore a very great contrast with what had been the situation before. For the end of chapter 3 speaks of judgment. See verse 24, "It shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell there shall be a stink, instead of a girdle a rent, and instead of a well-set hair baldness, and instead of a stomacher a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty in the war, and her gates shall lament and mourn, and she, being desolate, shall sit upon the ground." So there we have a very real contrast. And the reason is brought about because, verse 25, thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty in the war. And so scarce would men become, that verse 1, as seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread, you don't have to provide for us in any sense. We will wear our own apparel. Look at the apparel that they had had, which they had gloried in, expensive and excess was the hallmark of their apparel. But now they're prepared to provide for themselves in food and in raiment. Only one thing they asked: let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. Give us therefore any man who can help to rule over us, and give us a name whereby our family might be rebuilt. Now that scarcity of men was indicated earlier. Do you remember in verse 6 of chapter 3? When a man shall take hold of his brother of the house of his father, saying, thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let this ruin be under thy hand. Jerusalem, Judah was in a state of ruin. There was really needed a very wise man that would be able to restore and rebuild that place. But so lacking would there be of qualified men. And you remember how that in verse 2 and 3 it speaks of many very qualified men. They've gone. The mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, the honourable man, the counsellor, the cunning artificer, the eloquent orator. All of those have gone. And now a man might just find his brother. Well, you're clothed, you'll do. As such was the scarcity of qualified men to rule, so that any man might do. And that's how a woman would feel, who left destitute and wanting to build up her family, would say, look, you don't have to provide for me as a husband might normally do, but simply let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach, so that they could rebuild again their family. So here we have women, therefore, in a desperate position. To what time are we going to liken that? Well, we've said before, haven't we, that the early chapters of Isaiah have to do with the reign of Uzziah. Now, if we come back to the Chronicles record, you will remember that chapter 26 is the reign of Uzziah, that great and powerful king who for 52 years, had dominated Judah. And chapter 27 was his son Jotham, and chapter 28 was his very wicked grandson Ahaz, who began to reign when he was 20 years old and reigned only 16 years. But in chapter 28 and verse 15, look at this scene, my dear brothers and sisters. This is by the gates of Samaria, when the northern kingdom reigning in Samaria has come down to Judah, and they have taken captive, verse 8, the children of Israel to the tune of 200,000 women, sons and daughters. 200,000 women, sons and daughters are standing at the gates of Samaria. What a desperate and tragic position. Verse 15, and the men which were expressed by name rose up and took the captives, and with the spoil clothed all that were naked among them, and arrayed them and shod them, and gave them to eat and to drink, and anointed them, and carried all the feeble of them upon asses, and brought them to Jericho, the city of palm trees, to their brethren. Then they returned to Samaria. Well, that's 120,000 women who never had husbands, isn't it? 120,000 women, now desperate to rebuild their families, having lost their husbands in the battle. What a tragic time it was. And so that could well fit the circumstances that we have in Isaiah, chapter 4, where we have a desperate scarcity of males to build up these families in Israel, and so so many very destitute and worried women. Now, when we come back to Isaiah chapter 4, though, it's not quite as easy as that. We may say verse 1 fits very well. in the local, current circumstances in the days of the prophet. But look at verse 2 of Isaiah chapter 4. In that day shall the branch of Yahweh be beautiful and glorious. Who's that related to? It sounds to be like Christ, doesn't it? Sounds messianic. And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. The terms are very lofty, and there's no question that they are messianic. But let's first establish the power of this expression, the branch. In the Hebrew, it's this word. Semen. And it means a shooting. A shooting. It doesn't mean a branch with twigs and leaves. It means like something that might shoot up out of the ground. When a branch, a shoot comes through, doesn't have twigs, doesn't, or bark. It's not a branch in what we would understand by a branch at all. It's a shoot. And that's exactly what the word means and what it's used for. Now I want you to show you some very beautiful passages. In fact, if you've got good memories, this will remind you of our study on Zechariah. Who's got good memories? Where were the other passages that we found when we studied Zechariah only, what, 2 or 3 years ago, that had that word Samach? Do you remember? Perhaps we'll go back to Zechariah first and refresh your memory. Zechariah 3 and verse 8. And probably your Bible notes will remind you of the other passages. Hear now, O Joshua, chapter 3, verse 8, the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the Samach. There's our word. I will bring forth my servant, the Samach. The picture? There's Joshua, the high priest in the time of Reformation, had gone back from Babylon. And in the vision, the Spirit says, hear now, O Joshua, the high priest, thou and thy fellows who sit before thee, that is, the priests, his fellow priests, for they are men wondered at. Margin, they are men of sign. They're speaking of something greater than themselves. Speaking of a greater high priest who would have greater fellows associated with him. And then to make that clear, it says, for behold, I will bring forth my servant, the Samach. Now that's very clearly messianic, isn't it? I mean, wasn't Joshua the high priest of Zechariah's day God's servant? Yes, he was. Well, then why would the record say, for behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. I will bring him forth. There is something more personal about that, isn't there? And that, of course, is speaking of God's high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ, his son. Now, that word, that connotation of Samach, always has that sense of a son of God. I'm going to prove that to you. It's always lurking in the sense of it. I'm not saying that the expression itself has anything to do with sonship, but it always has the sense of something coming from God. This little shoot that comes not from some place originating with man, but sent of God. And the terms of verse 8 are in conformity with that. But look at verse 9. The figure changes, but the concept is exactly the same. For in verse 9 it says, for behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua. So the branch in another figure becomes the stone. The stone that I have laid before Joshua, Upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereon, saith Yahweh of hosts. And I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. My dear brothers and sisters, that is a wonderful verse. You could almost put that straight into the Gospel of John. Just perhaps a little explanation in brackets. What's that verse saying? Do you know what that verse is equivalent to? It's equivalent to John 3 and verse 16. What's John 3 and verse 16? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. How is the iniquity to be taken away? By God sending his Son. When he sent his Son, what would be the consequence of that? Everlasting life. You know, it's a great tragedy that in Australia in recent years we've had to counter a doctrine that can't see that the Son of God is unique. What a terrible thing that is. That's burning in that verse, isn't it? Burning in that verse. God says, I lay before him a stone. They were about building, weren't they? And so it was a different stone. It was a living stone. And God's eyes were upon it, seven eyes. All of his interest was dwelling upon that stone. And he says, I will engrave the graving thereof. And there were men out there working on other stones, making them fit to put in the temple. And God says, they're working on that, but I'm working on that, and my whole concentration is devoted to that. Isn't that beautiful? Absolutely glorious. You know, the parallel of that, keep your hand there, but the parallel of that is in the Psalms. Psalm 139. We won't stop here, but just to make sure that the full beauty of that passage is really appreciated. And I will engrave the engraving thereof. God was involved in the production of that psalm. For thou hast possessed my reins. You know these words well. Psalm 139 verse 13. Thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvellous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. You see, the seven eyes of God resting upon that, isn't it? The whole interest and perception and intent of God is involved in the making, the bringing forth of Mary's son. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. That's God bringing forth his son. Now that word has to do with embroidery, where you put various colours and shades into the cloth. Used of the veil when the scarlet and the red and the purple were worked into fine linen of the background. Thine eyes did see my substance. Seven eyes. Yet being imperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. Isn't that absolutely glorious? Well, that's what Zechariah is speaking about. Exactly the same thing. Behold the stone that I have laid before Joshua. It's a living stone. But one stone shall be seven eyes of divine interest. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith Yahweh of hosts. And I will remove the iniquity in that land in one day. Because he will be God's son, there will be hope of removing iniquity. What was needed to remove iniquity? A perfect life. One who could come and overcome the flesh. How would God do that? He would send one who was engraven by himself. Isn't that beautiful? What deep and wonderful things were revealed to those builders in the days of Zechariah. Now can you see, my dear brothers and sisters, how in that context that the connotation of a son of God, of someone coming direct from God, is involved? It's there, isn't it? No doubt about that. Chapter 6 and verse 12. Here's our word, Samach, again. It's not used very many times. Zechariah 3 verse 8, Zechariah 6 verse 12. Speak unto him, saying, thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, behold the man whose name is the Samak. And he shall Samak up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of Yahweh. Even he shall build the temple of Yahweh, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne. He'll be a king priest. He will sit and rule upon his throne, so he's a king. And he shall be a priest, the record says, upon his throne. So he's a king priest. And the council of peace shall be between both officers, for they will be brought together in one. So here we have again, there's someone that is different, even from the great high priest which they had, who was Joshua. This was a greater Joshua, a Jesus indeed, a greater Joshua, and he will grow up out of his place. And insomuch that it just puts it like that, he shall grow up out of his place, is another way of saying that he won't come by the will of man. It's not because he comes of a certain line that he will achieve these results. He shall samak, he shall shoot out of his place. So you've got the verb in the word grow, and you've got the noun in the word branch. So that shows you, doesn't it, the sense of the word branch. It's not like a branch on one of our trees. It has this idea of something shooting up. And of course, although this isn't the same word, everyone who heard that word would have thought of Isaiah 53, wouldn't they? Everyone. Everyone that had half an ear would have heard immediately these words in the back of his mind, but he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. You don't get a deliverer and a great one to overcome sin out of dry ground, except God has been involved in the sending forth of that shoot. Now that in Isaiah 53 is not the same word, but the sense is identical. So that's two passages in Zechariah. Now there were two in Jeremiah. We got the little note alongside those passages when we did Zechariah. What were they? Thanks, Ken. That's very encouraging. Because these are really very beautiful things, aren't they? What was the other one? Good. Oh, very reassured. Jeremiah 23. See if you can see the same sense here, my dear brothers and sisters. Aren't the scriptures absolutely beautiful, the way they're written? If we just read them sensitively and think about them, look what a wonderful lot comes that may not be there in actual word, but the sense is there. Rich and wonderful sense, the scriptures of truth. No book in all the rest of the world like this one. Jeremiah 23 verse 5. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord. Everybody got it? Jeremiah 23 verse 5. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch. That's our word. Now you know what that word means. It means a shoot. A righteous shoot. Springing up unexpectedly. And this is what he will be. And a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in his days. We might expect that because I will raise unto David a righteous shoot. And David was promised a king, wasn't he? But in the promise of 2 Samuel 7, though he would be David's son, what else did that promise say? The promise said, I will be his father. He shall be my son, reiterating the fact. Is that not involved in verse 5? It is, isn't it? Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will raise unto David. What about all the other children that had come from David already in Jeremiah's day? There'd been a whole line of kings from Zedekiah right back to David. But can you see, therefore, verse 5 is saying of something greater than that? If there's been that long line, it's got to mean something greater than that. I will raise unto David a righteous branch. And that, therefore, has the overtone of verse 14 of 2 Samuel 7, hasn't it? It's got the overtone of God's involvement, his specific and fatherly involvement, to bring forth a son. What would be the consequences of this one? Look at verse 6. In his days, Judah shall be saved, and Israel shall dwell safely. And this is his name whereby he shall be called, Yahweh, our righteousness. What's he going to do? He's going to bring in righteousness, as Daniel 9 would express it. He's going to be Messiah the Prince, to use Daniel's term, who's going to bring in everlasting righteousness. What shall they know him as? Yahweh, our righteousness. Through him, Yahweh's righteousness came to us and took away our sins. In brackets. Isn't that beautiful? Is that John 3:16? Of course it's John 3:16, isn't it? It's everything that John 3:16 is involved in Jeremiah 23, verse 5 and 6. God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth him should not perish but have everlasting life. You can't get everlasting life without Yahweh's gracious gift of righteousness. Isn't that glorious? Scriptures are wonderful. All right, the other one that Ken mentioned was the 33rd chapter. Our fourth reference in other places to this wonderful word, Semeh. Jeremiah 33, verse 15. In those days, and at that time, will I cause the branch. Same word. Write it in, because you see, if you don't, later on you go past and you say, look, I remember somebody saying something about that. I don't really remember when it was. I'm not quite sure what the word is. If you just write it in above the word, it's always there, isn't it? And you can sort of build on that because you've got the handle and grab hold of it. In those days and at that time will I cause the samak, the shoot. What shoot is it? The shoot of righteousness. Who will cause it? Yahweh will cause it. He's personally involved. I will cause the shoot of righteousness. There's all the echoes to chapter 23 and verse 16, isn't it? Bringing Yahweh's righteousness unto us. And he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. Those days shall Judah be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell safely. And this is the name wherewith she shall be called. She shall be called Yahweh, our righteousness. But it was the king that was called Yahweh our righteousness in Jeremiah 23 verse 16, wasn't it? Here it's now the city that is called Yahweh our righteousness. What's the idea of that? Well, when that king sits there and executes, as it says in verse 15, judgment and righteousness in the land, that city becomes permeated and filled, in fact flowing with righteousness and judgment. And so the city then becomes known by the king, doesn't it? His royal presence pervades every aspect of it. And so the city shall be called Yahweh our righteousness, named after its king. It couldn't have a higher name. So there's no question, is there, that all of those passages having to do with Samak are messianic. And if we take those back now into Isaiah chapter 4, we realise that we have a little conundrum. We explain verse 1 very easily in the terms of Isaiah's current generation. But if verse 2 is clearly messianic, and verse 2 begins in that day, then we've got to have a look at verse 1 again, don't we? Because it says in that day there. See the point I'm making? So how can we understand verse 1 in the terms of seven women taking hold of one man? We can see that when we think about it, can't we? Seven women, as it were, all women, or women of all nations, taking hold of one man and saying, grant us a name that we might be rebuilt again. Take away our reproach. And so we have, I believe, in a very beautiful spiritual fulfilment of verse 1, the bride of Christ taken out of many peoples, nations and tongues, that in absolute desolation and realizing their great inadequacy, personal inadequacy, take hold of the one man that God has provided, that they might have a redemption in him and take away their reproach. They put his name on them, don't they, in baptism, as Galatians 3 so well tells us. Are you happy with that? There's some beautiful things in this chapter, isn't it? Did you think this chapter was going to be as high as this? It's absolutely magnificent chapter. It's only 6 verses, but it's a real gem. An absolute gem. It's full, from the top to the bottom, you're going to find the whole thing's just like that. It's full of all sorts of wonderful things. All right, let's look at verse 2 again now. In that day shall the branch of Yahweh, the shoot of Yahweh, got all that background behind that, haven't we? Those 4 passages, Zechariah 3 verse 8, Zechariah 6 verse 12, Jeremiah 23 verse 5 and 6, and Jeremiah 33 verse 15 and 16. Did I get all those right, Ken? I thought you were checking me. All right. Oh, sorry. Yes, Isaiah 11 verse 2, but it's a different word, but it's exactly the same thing. I'm really glad. Would you pass me that in the question period? Because I just want to keep moving. But that's exactly the same sense, Bill. It's a beautiful related passage. Yeah, very true. But Isaiah 4 now, and verse 2 says that that shoot will be beautiful and glorious. Have you ever heard those two words together before? Beautiful and glorious. Apart from John Martin's talks. Have you heard them in the scripture before? Beautiful and glorious. Yeah, almost the same, isn't it? Beauty and glory. Two nouns for beauty and glory. And that's in Exodus 28, verse, very special garments he was given. There was no one in Israel that had anything like them. They were the most beautiful and ornate garments in all of Israel. Now, do you know that that is exactly what you've got in verse 2? Can you see the margin? The margin of my Bible for beautiful and glorious says beauty and glory. It's the same two words. The same two words that are used to describe the garments of the high priest. Now, my dear brothers and sisters, what is the record getting at? Let's read verse 2 objectively again, right? In that day shall the shoot of Yahweh be beauty and glory. Now, compare that to Exodus 28, verse 2. Verse 2 of Exodus 28, and thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron thy brother for glory and for beauty. What's the difference? What's the difference between the two descriptions? They're reversed. But that's, yes, okay, there's a difference there. But that's not really what I want. What's the real difference? The essential difference.
One's for beauty and for glory, but the other is beauty.
Excellent. That's right. One is the garments that you put on, but in the other case, the person is beauty and glory. Get the point? Because it didn't really matter, did it? How beautiful those garments if there was a scoundrel underneath? And there was from time to time Hophni and Phinehas, wicked men. They wore those garments. You see, it wasn't that they wore beautiful garments, it was that they were beautiful men. That was what God was trying to say, wasn't it? That they should be what they seem to be on the outside. And so when we come back to Isaiah 4, my dear brothers, look how beautiful these things are. In that day shall the shoot of Yahweh, something that shall come from Him, it will be beauty and glory. It's not going to be a show. It's going to be itself, that which the external had always spoken about. Now you know, my dear brothers and sisters, when you think about that, it's interesting, isn't it? If you look at priests in today's world, they have very beautiful garments. You look at a Roman Catholic priest, magnificent attire. You look at all the attire that the Pope's got. You've seen sometimes in white, and other times in red, and other times in purple, and sometimes combinations of both, all types of different hats. And all the priests have got all different types of garments they wear on different occasions. And when you see them in procession, you see a whole host of priests and cardinals and nuns and what have you. They can look at very colourful things. Do you know what they call that? They call it their habit, don't they? So a nun has a habit. Why do they call it a habit? Because she always wears it. It's her habit to wear it, isn't it? Why do they call it her habit? Never thought of that, have I? Why do they call it a habit? Because originally the idea was that she should dress to indicate what she really was inside, or what he was inside. That's why they called the word habit. Not because she was habitually seen in that, but rather that was reflecting what she really should be in person. Interesting. And that's what our outside should always reflect. Here we have someone who is everything that he should be. What a beautiful sense that there is involved in that. It's the perfect answer to David's prayer in Psalm 132. I shouldn't say David's prayer, because we're not certain that it's David's prayer at all. It's so often said that we assume it is, but very good reasons to believe that it is. But verse 9 says, "Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness, and let thy saints shout for joy. For thy servant David's sake, turn not away the face of thine anointed." And then later, that request is answered. Verse 16. "I will also clothe her priests with salvation." And what is salvation if it is not joy? Or what joy is there that's greater than salvation? You see, it's a perfect answer. See? "Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness, and let thy saints shout for joy. I will also clothe her priests with salvation, and her saints shall shout aloud for joy." It's the perfect answer, and that's what the whole psalm's like, isn't it? So there was the request here, in fact, in Isaiah 4, is a beautiful fulfilment of exactly that. But why, thinking again, why should the record start to talk like this? Can you see why it's speaking like this? Perhaps if we just tie that thought up in our mind for a moment, we'll come back to that in a minute. Give you a little bit of time to think about that. It goes on to say, "And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely before those that are escaped of Israel." There's a remnant, in other words, that are escaped. The remnant is again spoken of twice in verse 3 in similar language. That he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem. That's three descriptions of the same thing. It's the remnant doctrine again. We'll come to that in a moment. But it had said, "The fruit of the earth," which is a very general term, "shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel." Now there is a relationship, isn't there, between fruit and the shoot. For a shoot doesn't come up without it has an intention. And its intention is that it shall be fruitful. When you put a thing into the ground, its intention is that it's fruitful. That's why you put it in the ground. So there's a relationship between the branch and the fruit. They are one, aren't they? The fruit comes forth of him. So what verse 2 is saying is that this branch will come forth and it will bud and blossom and fill the earth with fruit. That's what it's saying, isn't it? It's going to, by God's grace, it's going to fulfill that which was its promise. It will truly fulfill what God intended. Isn't it a beautiful chapter? It's a very beautiful chapter, isn't it? And it says then, for them that are escaped of Israel. We come back to the remnant doctrine of this book. Chapter 1 verse 9 is where we first had reference to that. We made a list of references alongside verse 9, didn't we? Except Yahweh of hosts, 1 verse 9, had left unto us a very small remnant, which should have been as Sodom and Gomorrah, like unto Gomorrah. So that's the same group. That's the same group. They are fruit of the earth, excellent, comely. So on the one hand you've got that which is beauty and glory, and on the other hand you've got that which is excellent and comely. You see what the point's being made? They are akin to that, aren't they? They are of that, so they're the same in type. He might be the first fruits, they're a kind of first fruits. To use Paul's expression in James 1 verse 18. A kind of first fruits. Christ the first fruits, a kind of first fruits after him. They've got his hallmarks on them. He's excellent, or rather, beauty and glory, and they are comely and excellent. Beautiful, really beautiful things. They're akin to him. They've dwelt in the vine. What about the others? Come through to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Keeping our hand where we had it. Deuteronomy 32. Verse 32. This is the rest. There's nothing that's a true flavour in this. It's corrupt. It's been soured by an evil source. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. He's already used that language in chapter 1 verse 9, hasn't he? 1 verse 9 and 10. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. You see, it brings forth after its kind, doesn't it? As Jesus said. When he said that, he had these passages in mind. You see, it's not the taste of his children, is it? It's not a true flavour of his children. It's a foreign taste. Their wine is the brew, as it were, of Sodom and Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. Is not this, verse 33, their wine is the poison of dragons and their cruel venom of asps. Is not this laid up in store with me and sewered up among my treasures? You see, this shoot is going to be a vine. It's already used the language of a plant in chapter 3 of Isaiah. In chapter 3 of Isaiah in verse 14. It spoke there, didn't it? For ye have eaten up the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. You've eaten up the vineyard. And in chapter 5 and verse 1, it speaks again of the vineyard, doesn't it? So we're reasonably assured in saying in verse 2 of Isaiah 4 that this little shoot that is going to come up is going to have the qualities of a vine. And the fruit, therefore, is going to be clusters of grapes, beautiful symbols of the ecclesia, and they're going to bear the same flavour as that which comes up through the Son of God. And they are going to be true to flavour. Isn't that glorious? What beautiful things they are. Really beautiful things. Tucked here in Isaiah chapter 4, but until a couple of years ago I hardly knew anything about. You know, we don't read the scriptures carefully enough, do we? Do you feel a bit ashamed about the way we read the scriptures? Really, this. Beautiful things, aren't they? Beautiful things. Rich, full for our enjoyment. So, in this verse then, we have all kinds of similes. That day shall the branch of Yahweh be beauty and glory. My dear brothers and sisters, why then should he, going back to that question I put to you before, why then should he have taken the adjectives and turned them into nouns of the high priest's garments? Any suggestions on that? Any other garments mentioned? Yes, he is the king priest. Yes, that's absolutely right. But you see, there are other garments mentioned, weren't there? And all through that chapter, you've got a unique chapter, or the last 10 verses of chapter 3, you've got an unequaled repetition of all the stuff that the women wore in Israel to make themselves attractive. Drawing attention to themselves. Can you see the point? We've already noted that there's a connection between chapter 3 and chapter 4. So here now we have the one who's not wearing all the trinkets and all the rings and nose jewels and changeable suits of apparel, verse 22, and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, the glasses and the fine linen and the hoods and the veils. He is beauty and glory. Can you see the point? Isn't that lovely? Isn't that beautiful? And standing there, so obvious, really, isn't it? It's a contrast of chapter 4, verse 2, with all that gaudy rubbish that was being seen in the streets of Jerusalem and preeminently around the temple on the days of high ceremony. Days which were holy assemblies, which they had turned in, not being a worship of God, but the pouring out of the heart and the going down in reverence to God and feeling the need of Him. But it was a time of show, and the women of the nation, abreast of their eminent men, whether they be honourable counsellors or orators or whatever it might be, men that were honoured in that nation, they came abreast of them. They took their places with pomp and glory in competition with God. That's what it was. He had said there should be one who should move among them with beautiful garments. It was for them to come decked with chastity and sobriety in respect of God's high priest. Upon his forehead it bore the term, didn't it? Holiness to Yahweh. Now these women, in all their bravery, see that word in verse 18, in that day Yahweh will take away the bravery. You know, that's just like our women in our world. And I think last time we appealed, didn't we, for all of our young girls to see that clearly. Girls don't want to emulate the girls outside because they've got 25 bangles up their arm and all the rest of it. We don't have to look like them. The response comes to us when we dress our children. We want to preserve them so that when the day of resurrection comes and their grandmas and their great-grandparents and those who built the ecclesia are united with those that are in this generation, there will be an affinity, and the grandmas won't look at them and say, goodness gracious, isn't it? Whatever's gone on. Wouldn't that be sad? But it's going to happen. It's going to happen. If we don't preserve that sanctity. Do you know, the comparison is even greater than that. There are words used poignantly by the prophet to describe their attire which are only otherwise used of the high priest and the priestly garments. For example, verse 16 and 17. Because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet. Ever heard that before? Anywhere in the scripture? Who made a tinkling with his feet? Steve?
The oldest Muslim arranged
That's right. Exodus 28. I'm sure there's no one else in the whole nation that did that. Exodus 28. The bells around the garment of the high priest. Exodus 28, verse 33. And beneath upon the hem of it thou shalt make pomegranates of blue and of purple and of scarlet round about the hem thereof, and bells of gold between them round about, a golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate upon the hem of the robe around about. Why do you think God did that? It's a funny thing to do, you might say, on a man's garment, to put pomegranates and bells. Why do you think he did that? I suppose we really have to put ourselves into that environment, don't we? And we've come to the temple to offer, and we've prepared our minds and we've prepared our offerings. Our family has been prepared, and we've come with sobriety to that temple. And as we're in the precincts of that temple, and everybody's quiet, and there's a hush, because it's a place of worship. You know, don't want to forget that ourselves, you know, on Sunday mornings. Increasingly people are saying, our meeting is very noisy. And the high priest could come down the middle there, and I don't think we'd even know he was there. But there came down little bells around the corner, and everybody was drawn back, wouldn't they? The high priest. Can't be anybody else. The high priest is coming. And so they would have been brought to his very presence, an aura that was right and meet for the high priest to have in the midst of Israel. Now what we have? Oh, it's a happy feast day or assembly. And I'm all come with the women, dressed like you can have a guess what, plastered up as you can imagine, gold and silver dripping off them, streaming up to the temple, having a great old time, bells around their feet. You wouldn't know where the high priest was. And as far as everybody looking for him as the holiness of Yahweh, as the centre of attention, these women, you see, were drawing attention unto them. You can see the picture now, can't you? It's clear as a bell. Very clear. This was in competition with the only other person who was ever instructed to wear bells by his feet. Isn't that beautiful? What a magnificent concept. God did not want any competition. Verse 24 speaks of a stomacher. Excuse my mirth. And instead of a stomacher, I don't know quite what a stomacher is, but anybody like to guess? It's very interesting to look at that whole list of things in other translations. You'll find it's really quite comical. All the things that have ever been done, done today, have always ever been done. But here's the interesting thing. It's the same word as embroidered coat in Exodus 28 and verse 4. It's the same word. In verse 22, we've got the expression suits of apparel. The only other reference to that is in Zechariah chapter 3, where it says, give unto Joshua a change of garments. Zechariah 3 and verse 22. He was a high priest, wasn't he? In verse 23, it speaks of hoods. And again in Zechariah 3, verse 5, that's translated a fair mitre. Headgear, in other words. So there are deliberate comparisons. Verse 18, that word bravery is the word beauty of Exodus 28 and verse 2. So you can see, can't you, what God is doing by dropping those little words into the record. And then by changing the sense from not that which is outside to that which is inside. You know, the outside always reflects the inside. I remember somebody saying to me once, doesn't matter what you wear, it's what's inside. And of course, there's a certain appeal about those words, and there's a certain truth to them, isn't there? Certain truth to them. If a person, as we're seeing here, should wear the high priest's garments but be a Hophni or Phineas within, then that's not much good, is it? So it is what's important that's inside. So I agreed with the person and I said to him, but what do you do when you get a new suit? Do you send your wife? send your son to get it. No, he's going to town. I said, that's what I do. How do you buy it? He said, well, get the man to see if it fits. I said, what do you do? Does he put you in a little room? Oh, yes. I said, do you look at it something? Yes. What do you look at? Well, the mirror. Now, you look at yourself, don't you? You see, when we choose clothing, we choose it because that's what we want to look like.
It suits.
It suits. You see, it's a very silly argument that says that what we wear doesn't count, because what we wear is chosen by our minds. And we look in the mirror and we see whether that's what we want to look like or not. And it's our minds that make that decision. And there's lots of things in our minds at that time, aren't there? We think about our meetings. We think about the example of other people. And we think about what our example will be to other people too, don't we? So we've got to be very careful and circumspect, and therefore, in the way that we fashion ourselves, because here is a deliberate contrast. You know, you go and have a look outside some of the churches on a Sunday and see what you will see. Or go to a high church where a lot of wealthy people go, and you'll see those women come in, you know, with all sorts of things in their hair and their hats, all stuck there, and their hair's done up like a glory, and they come in with shoulders that would do a rugby player, and in they bowl with Mr. So-and-so alongside them, and you think to yourself, goodness sake, that's worship. How did they ever get like that? They walked in here like that. We'd just look aghast, wouldn't we? But I can think of Christadelphian meetings that are not much different sometimes. Overdone. When really we come to worship. And that doesn't mean we should not be clean and decent, as we said last time. We don't come to the meeting as though we're going to watch a football match, or as if we're going to do the gardening. There are clothes for going for a hike. There's clothes to come to the meeting. We come here circumspectly and with sobriety, but not with show. Not the very best of this or the best of that. It's not what we're there for. You know what that does? It evokes competition and emulation. Very akin, but they're not exactly the same. That's what it evokes. Until we all get that way, it's okay. And you look at a Christadelphia meeting and think, wherever have they gone? Why doesn't somebody say something? Very hard to say when the tide's gone out. So let's make sure, brethren and sisters, that we are very careful, that we nurture that inner adorning that the Apostle Peter speaks about, and have more awareness and concern for that than how we appear, so that at our meetings God is glorified. A robe of display. Well, that says it all, doesn't it? A robe of display. Well, there was judgment coming for that. And in verse 16 it says, of the previous chapter, I'm just picking it up again in the fourth chapter. We'll come over verse 3 and it says, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. Now look at the description there. All that beautiful array, all that expensive concentration, he has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. That's God's estimation. When he is not honored, purge the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. And in chapter 3, that sense of judgment for this was also indicated in these words, verse 17, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and Yahweh will discover their secret parts. And we remember, don't we, how that would happen in the history that was coming up upon them, when they would be brought to the house, to the door of Samaria. They're some 50 miles north, and there their poor women were naked, with their women, with their sons and their daughters. What a terrible thing. That happened literally. They wanted to display themselves and all of this ornate stuff. And God said, look, there'll be a day you'll be in nakedness and in shame. And he furthermore said, the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head. You know what the scab is? It's the first beginnings of leprosy used in the 13th chapter of Leviticus in verse 2. And that word burnings of verse 24 is the word for inflammatory pain of leprosy. In Leviticus 13 and verse 24. Leprosy. Leprosy. Who had leprosy in the days of Isaiah? The king. Here's a promise that they all would have leprosy. Perhaps not literally so. But you see, what happened to the king was only really symbolic of what happened to the nation. Like king, like people. And God says, as I have therefore struck him with that leprosy. And it hadn't occurred at this point, I'm sure. And so the people would be struck in a similar kind. Verse 14, shall come to pass, 24, shall come to pass, instead of sweet smell, shall be stink. You know, I don't like to smell our meetings overpowering with perfume. It never used to be so. That we should be clean and fresh is one thing. But that we should be like Max Factor walking in the door is another thing. And we don't really need to be like that, do we? It's just another thing that happens today, happened then. There is a proper balance in those things. And instead of a girdle, a rent. And instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth. And burning instead of beauty. Then he takes up that word beauty, you see in verse 2 of chapter 4. Isn't that beautiful? What a glorious drift of thought is involved in those things. The king's leprosy would be symbolic of the plague of judgment that God would bring also upon the daughters of Zion.
Peter wrote,
that's
two
Sorry?
Two
oh, yes. Yeah, no doubt about that. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes. That's right. That's right. And at 87, again, John, again, when a remnant was saved. Now, just coming then through verse 3, it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem. Two other phrases that coupled with that last phrase of chapter 2 were speaking of the remnant doctrine. Why did God say that three times? I suppose for the same reason that we are told and told and told that Christ is coming. We don't learn it the first time, do we? And they were told and told and told. Paul the Apostle says, was not Israel told? He quotes these passages. They were surely told that it would only be a remnant, yet they still would not confine themselves to the qualities of the remnant. You know, the bearing of that upon us is very great, very great indeed, isn't it? It won't be all of Christadelphia that will be saved. It will be those who have steadfastly put their minds, their interests to the things of God, put their hearts dedicatedly to that end, and fashioned their ways. Let us hear, therefore, the doctrine of the remnant. And then it says that they shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. Isn't that interesting? Do you see what the margin says? Written for life. Written for life in Jerusalem. You can be written in the book of life. And there's your name. And alongside it, it says, for life. You have a look in the 1 Corinthians 7 and see there's another similar use in the Greek world, where alongside a slave's name there was an inscription put for freedom. That's the same type of thing. There's the name for life. Where's it written? In Jerusalem. When Jerusalem is made glorious, that person will be remembered for life. Isn't that beautiful? So there's a reference to the book of life. Earlier spoken of in Exodus 32, verse 32. We won't turn that up, but that's the other reference, earlier reference in the scriptures to it when Moses used the term. So this remnant will be written for life. Verse 4 has the contrast, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the majority, the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof. What does it mean, the blood of Jerusalem? Chapter 1, verse 15 speaks about your hands are full of blood. In verse 21, there were murderers within the city, getting away with it, because they were in cahoots with the elders of the land. He will purge the blood of Jerusalem. He will not let murder go on without its avenged. He says that, doesn't he, in Genesis chapter 9. So he will purge the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. That's the same word as chapter 3, verse 24. Burning, that has that intensity that gets into the matter and takes and burns away that which is evil. And look at verse 5 and 6. What a glorious picture is now here in the conclusion of our study. Beautiful picture. And Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies. Remember the assemblies of chapter 1? Verse 13, bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with it. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. God ran away from it. He couldn't bear it. Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion. Can you hear an echo to that? In my Father's house are many abiding or dwelling places. John chapter 14, verse 2. I go to prepare a place for you. Jerusalem is seen as a place of many dwelling places. And Yahweh is creating upon each one of them. And upon her assemblies, that is, when they come from their individual abiding places, to a joyous assembly, Yahweh, as the superintendent, as the master of ceremonies, as it were, as the director, he's totally involved. He's not running away from it as in chapter 1. He's creating, at that time, his own presence. A cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. Now you know what that language is, don't you? That's the language of the tabernacle. When God came by night and he was seen as a pillar of cloud, or pillar of fire rather, above the camp, so that these people that had been taken out from Egypt and wandered all these years and thought that they might be going to nowhere could look up and see that despite the number of years, despite their wanderings, God was with them. They were going somewhere. And there was a cloud by day that kept drifting along. And so they went on. They knew that God was there. But now it's come to rest. Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place. And the contrast is clear, isn't it? Before it was only upon the tabernacle. That's where God dwelt, upon the tabernacle. But now in the dwelling place of all that fruit that are like the high priest who was at the tabernacle, upon every dwelling place or abiding place, God is resting and his presence is with them. That's the sense of it, isn't it? They are all like the high priest. They are all with holiness and sobriety. And God is dwelling among them. He doesn't want to run away. He wants to fully cooperate and be with them. More than that, it says then, for upon all the glory shall be a defence. And the word defence doesn't really mean a defence in that term. It's really used of a nuptial canopy where the bride and the bridegroom should be
joined together. There was a little canopy made. It was part of their wedding breakfast. And it was a very, very wonderful thing. It spoke of the unity of that couple at the very set reception. And Yahweh said, over all of Jerusalem, there will be a wedding canopy, a nuptial canopy, and I will unite with my bride. It's more than defence. There's love and care and rest and peace as Yahweh is united with his people. Isn't that beautiful, my dear friends? What a total contrast with that which had been. The words used in Psalm 19 verse 5, which says that the bridegroom shall be, or rather the son shall be as the bridegroom who ariseth from his chamber. That's the same word as what we have here. So we have a city who becomes a bride, and Yahweh marries the bride. That's Revelation chapter 21, isn't it? And it's Isaiah chapter 54, which we haven't time to refer to. But it's the same thoughts involved and implied in verse 5. And then, verse 6, the all-encompassing security of this nuptial canopy, this presence, this love of God, is emphasized, that there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the day, daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a cover from storm, rain, whatever circumstance will be perfectly provided for when God is resting over all the dwelling places of Jerusalem. That's our hope. What a wonderful chapter. What an inspiring thing. Do you know, Isaiah was given 700 years before Christ. Been resting in the scriptures all that time. It's full of beautiful things like that. Let us read the scriptures carefully and respectfully and enjoy what they have to say. And let us go home, my dear brothers and sisters, and let those beautiful things rest in our own hearts.
Brethren and sisters, we'd like to thank our brother Brian very much for his ministrations to us this evening. There are a couple of minutes available for any questions or comments that any of us might have.
I've written that up, Brother Gary, but rather than duplicate it on that machine tonight before the class, I thought it would be better to send it down to David and get him to do it so we can get a good sharp copy. And because of that, I avoided Hebrews 12 a bit. I was going to work on the blackboard if we got time with it, but I could see I couldn't do that. But quickly have a look at Hebrews 12. Hasn't it sometimes seemed to you curious, my dear brothers and sisters, as to why the Apostle Paul in Hebrews 12 and verse 22 should have a whole list of items there? How many items has he got there to describe the same thing on me? Ye are come unto Mount Zion. Alright, that's one. Unto the city of the living God. They're really specific and interesting things. The heavenly Jerusalem. To an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly, and six, an ecclesia of the firstborns, who are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and the spirits of just men made perfect. You have wondered whatever they're all put together. It is a real challenge, isn't it? Why put all those things together like that? Now, Bible student will think about that, won't you? Go and really think about why he should put all those things together. Well, I believe in Isaiah 4 is the key to that. If it doesn't unlock every phrase, as Brother Gary has noted, there are very clear overtones. Keep your hand in Hebrews 12. Ye are come unto Mount Zion, says Paul. Where's that in Isaiah 4? Can you remember the term Mount Zion very often in the scripture? It's not many times, is it? Mount Zion. You won't find many references to that. There's one in Isaiah 4. Where is it? Verse 5. Every dwelling place of Mount Zion. Unto the city of the living God. Is that echoed in Isaiah chapter 4? Doesn't it say in verse 5 of Isaiah 4 that Yahweh will create and he will dwell there with them and live with them? Isn't that the very essence of what that verse might be saying? Isn't that the living God? Not the paraphernalia and the dead worship which they had in their temple as it was. But when it would be a living God working and living with and loving, a living people. That's the whole sense of it, really, isn't it? But there's some things that are even more specific that will give you more security to grab hold of the point. It then says, the heavenly Jerusalem. You take that back in the terms of Isaiah 4, there was a Jerusalem. It was there, but it was earthly, wasn't it? This is speaking of another Jerusalem, which clearly was of God who would create it. So it was a heavenly Jerusalem. It speaks of Jerusalem, doesn't it? Verse 3. Then going back to Hebrews 12, it says, and to an innumerable company of angels. How many angels rested over the tabernacle? What do you think the pillar of fire was? Literal fire, stoked up with wood? It was an angel, wasn't it? It was the presence of God, seen in the angel, that was speaking of God's presence with them. But he says, I will create upon every dwelling place an innumerable company of angels. Is the sense of that, is it not? For if what was upon one dwelling place is going to be upon many, won't it mean that God is with men and that his angels are with them? Then it says, to the general assembly. Does that word occur in Isaiah? Verse 5. And upon her assemblies, when people come together. This is the general assembly. It's like none other. It's the great congregation, if you like, to use the term of Psalm 22. So it's the general assembly, says the apostle, lifting it up more than norms, more than assemblies that were in the Mosaic. This is greater than them. What's the next phrase? And the ecclesia of the firstborn. Didn't we notice in chapter 4 and verse 2 that the fruit was like the one from which it originated? That he was the firstborn, the first fruits, and they were like him, comely and excellent, like his beauty and glory. Furthermore, it says in verse 23, who are written in heaven, enrolled, the margin says, enrolled in heaven. Didn't we have that very idea in Isaiah chapter 4 and verse 3? Even every one that is written among or for life in Jerusalem. The echoes are all there. But you may still say to me, well, why did the apostle do that? Why does he pick up Isaiah 4 and put that into Hebrews 12? Because Hebrews 12 is dealing with this. There was the people who were going back to Mount Sinai, which was altogether on a smoke, which was quaking, in which the voice of words came forth, in which the fire was seen. The manifestation of God was seen upon that mountain in awe-inspiring terror. And the people fell back from it. And the apostle said, you are not come unto Mount Zion, or rather unto the mount that might be touched and that shook and for which people trembled and went away. but ye are come unto Mount Zion. And he wishes them to think of a passage which has that sense of drawing God's people to it. He couldn't think of a better one than Isaiah 4, because that's exactly what that's saying. He ran away from the other, but to this he was coming to create it and drawing his people there and casting over them a canopy of love. Ye are come unto Mount Zion, where God is inviting and wishing to enroll, placing you among his firstborns as the fruit of him, his Son.